You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garton, which is looking at the future of the corporation. Last show, we were looking at the section Being Global. There is a third business model for going global. It involves neither mega mergers nor expansion primarily by alliance, but relies instead on organic growth. This doesn't mean the absence of mergers or alliances, just that neither is on a scale that dominates all else. GE has made hundreds of acquisitions abroad, but they've been small enough that there were very few problems in post-merger consolidation and in maintaining the GE culture, at least that is until its $45 billion acquisition of Honeywell International in October 2000. Another example is Merrill Lynch, which has not followed a mega-merger strategy, but has grown steadily by small acquisitions and by setting up its own operations. Toyota hasn't made any foreign acquisitions of note at all. In some ways, firms that can do this have a great advantage because their strategy and their culture are less encumbered than are just merged or alliance-dominated firms. An example of this is Nokia. Nokia grew the business by internal growth and not by acquisitions, says Jorma Olia. The reason was that corporate culture is the key. In the high technology area, there really aren't many examples of successful acquisitions or mergers because you fall into situations where the cultures clash and it's very, very difficult to weld them together. So we did it on our own. We want to be an informal, unbureaucratic, flat organization, an entrepreneurial company where people feel that they can find an expression for their willingness to perform. It's a family atmosphere with a fierce hunger for achievement, a meritocracy with a fair way of compensating for achievement. We wanted people to look at this company and say, "This is an exciting place. Here is the management style that feels good to me. I want to give some of the best years of my life to this company." However, there is a price to pay for expansion by small increments. Growth can be slower. Cultural diversity far less than optimal. There is no ideal balance. The most basic problem facing a CEO is to reconcile multiple layers of complexity, cultural and organizational, and with all other requirements of leadership and strategy. Running a multinational magnifies all the challenges that a purely national company once had and adds some new ones. Special issues arise, including how to be big enough to be a credible global player, but at the same time flexible and adaptable enough to move with the rapidly changing currents that the pace of trade liberalization and deregulation, the rise of big emerging markets, and the internet will bring. How do you expand your diversity of talent and still maintain a coherent corporate culture? How do you leverage your assets around the world so that you are far more than the sum of the individual parts of a global company? How do you lead and manage a complicated multinational firm where effective control by any chief executive may simply be out of reach? It's not that CEOs don't recognize these problems. They live with them every day. But they will have to become smarter and faster, even as they dig increasingly deeper into what it means not just to be an international company, but to make the most out of globalization itself. Part 2. Everyday Concerns. Chapter 4. True North and Other Virtues. Jack Welch, who has been the epitome of successful command and control leader, doesn't hesitate to predict the end of his own era. Leadership of companies is going to have become much less of a CEO-driven concern, he says. People within the company are going to have so much data in their hands that they will be able to challenge a CEO's decisions all the time. The pace of events is going to be so fast that people aren't going to wait for the next layer of approvals. There's going to have to be far more delegation. There's going to have to be far more participation. The leader must become an ever more engaging coach, an ever more engaging person. You're going to have to create an environment where excitement reigns, where the challenges are everywhere, and where the rewards are both in the wallet, yes, but also in the soul. But how? Every CEO knows that the rigidities of the old command and control models of management simply won't work in the new world economy. They all understand the need to flatten hierarchies, streamline reporting lines, and create an entrepreneurial environment within their companies. All observed with speeding up decision making. It's fair to say as well that most top executives embrace time-tested leadership qualities. Mitsubishi's corporate chairman, Minoru Mikihara, is one such traditionalist. Quote, ultimately comes down to the ability to convey one's ideas convincingly down the line. And whether it's today or 10 years ago, it hasn't changed. He said, John Brown of BP agreed, quote, a leader's job is to decide on what direction an organization will take. There has to be a decision, and our shareholders will have to see that clarity. The new economy prompts major questions about the ability of CEOs to hold on to the traditional qualities of leadership in an era of blinding change. A central issue that arose from my interviews is the importance of a leader's having a strong compass in the storm of what we call the Third Industrial Revolution, and also to confront the sheer difficulty on staying on course. Another is the need for CEOs to be trusted by their employees, and the need for trust to develop between a company and its constituents. And this, too, has become much tougher to achieve. I heard a ringing endorsement of the need for a CEO to be centered and trusted, but after thinking about what I was told against the backdrop of the new economy, I felt that these qualities are becoming increasingly elusive, even as they grow more important. Many theories address leadership in the new economy. Leaders should be coaches. They should be nannies. They should be servants. Leadership should flow from the bottom to the top. Most CEOs do not pay much attention to these soundbite philosophies. In fact, most are much more preoccupied with a few basics, which themselves are hard enough to maintain these days. Bain and Company's Orit Gadish acknowledged that many of the traditional constituents are becoming unglued. People are changing jobs faster and faster. Customers are shopping around much more than they used to. Shareholders who were once loyal are churning their portfolios at amazing rates. But she believes that despite the pace of change, or perhaps because of it, a leader who can provide a steady anchor is more critical than ever to the survival and success of the big organization. She calls this anchoring, quote, true north, unquote, a combination of character and principle that makes it crystal clear what the leader, and by extension his organization, stands for. Using her company as an example, she says it has always stood for the results that produce action, which is a way of thinking that is at odds with most people's image of a high-powered consulting firm. Quote, you have to think about an organization in a special way if your objective is to generate bottom-line results, she told me. It's not about writing reports. That could easily lead to nothing. People make things happen, not reports. This issue is, how do you facilitate a decision in your client? You need to focus all your work on making sure that once answers have been found, they will actually be implemented. This requires working with people who will ultimately be responsible for implementation. You need to work with your clients, not just for them. That is why we don't write reports, and oftentimes we don't present conclusions. We prefer that the clients who've been working with us all along present to the board and to the CEO the purpose of our work, that is, to solve problems. It's not to arrive on the scene and demonstrate how smart we are. The work shouldn't be about consultants, but it should be focused on the client. In the pursuit of real solutions, moreover, Bain and Company will not take an assignment just to ratify what a company has already decided to do. We won't tell a CEO what he wants to hear simply to get a contract. Sometimes we lose business this way, but at least people know what we stand for. True North is easier to spot than to define. It is more than such values as putting the client first or treating employees with integrity. It also differentiates leaders and their firms from competitors. True North reflects a certain consistency over a long period of time, even as the business environment or company strategy changes. It is the philosophy that holds an organization together and gives its people collective pride in their work. It has to begin with the CEO, but top management must infuse it throughout the organization. Quote, you only know whether you have a true north when there are painful trade-offs and the organization is tested by adversity and emerges from it still holding on to its basic character, says Galish. A contemporary example of an executive with True North is Richard Branson, chairman of Virgin Management. Headquartered in London The $5 billion Virgin business empire encompasses airlines, trains, records, soft drinks, financial services, telecommunications, wedding stores, and soon perhaps the management of England's national lottery. We met one morning in the trendy Royalton Hotel in New York. I in a coat and tie, he in a black denim jeans and short sleeve shirt. And we sank into two comfortable chairs in the lobby for a long discussion. Branson, who dropped out of school at 15, formed his business philosophy in the anti-establishment counterculture of the 1960s. And apparently he never abandoned that cause, even as he rose to fame in one of England's great business entrepreneurs, established a world-class brand, and ended up being knighted by Queen Elizabeth. However, I was surprised by his apparent shyness. Branson doesn't use the term True North. In fact, I had to explain what I meant by it. But he has it. Quote, the core thing is absolutely and utterly the people who work for a company. And if those people are proud of the company they work for, if they respect it and are listened to, the company will thrive. And so, I think the number one most important role for anybody running a company is finding the time for the people who are out on the front line making things work, he explained. Branson explained to me some of the ways he says, the way he stays close to his employees. Quote, last night when I came to New York, I was very tired, he said. But I made absolutely sure that I took 150 of my employees out. Not to a formal dinner, but to Mr. Chow's, so that we could let our hair down, get drunk, and have a good time. But I also sat down and listened and talked to them and made notes, which I dealt with that very next day. And it's often the little things that can turn a positive workforce against the company. Last night I learned that we'd be giving free beers to all of the airline crews when they arrived in their hotels. Suddenly someone decided to dock their monies by $2 a beer. You know, something crass and stupid. But if I hadn't been out drinking with my employees, I may never have learned that tiny little but important fact. And that sort of damage can be done very quickly. Branson makes it a point to stay in touch with employees he doesn't see as well. Quote, I write to all my staff every month and tell them everything that's going on. And I find in any one day, I'll get 20 to 25 letters from people who work for various Virgin companies. And those letters are critical for me to be able to get feedback to make sure management is making all the right decisions. I suppose I've almost become, you know, we don't have a union at Virgin, and I've sort of become the head of the union, making sure that employees are well looked after and happy and enjoying their jobs. It's not necessarily salaries that are the key here. I really think that would be quite low on the list. It's, are they being listened to? If they come out with an idea, is it going to go through, or is it just going to be buried in bureaucracy? All the little things matter. Getting back to the airlines, is the uniform that the crew is wearing something they feel good in? Are the hotels they are staying in pleasant enough? Or are they just being put into an airport hotel warehouse? Branson wants his employees actually to have fun, and he himself sets an example. He once appeared at a London event in drag to launch a new line of wedding gowns. He posed with nude models to announce his new cellular telephone business. He drove a tank down New York's Fifth Avenue to introduce Virgin Cola to the United States. His risky hot air balloon excursions have been publicity stunts as well as sport. Quote, "I think that far too many chief executives sit in their ivory towers and plan things and forget that even the most stuffy-looking business person actually wants to enjoy himself, wants to let his hair down, and wants to have a good time. If, as chairman of the company, I'm not having fun, I'm not going to want to take the trouble to get up in the morning and work really that hard. So the chairman has got to go have fun. So you've got to be the first into the swimming pool with your clothes on, whatever. The first to let your hair down. The first to make a fool out of yourself on stage singing karaoke. The first to break the ice so that everyone else knows how far they can actually go to have fun." You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're looking at the chapter, True North and Other Virtues. Many of the CEOs I have met have a true north. For Michael Dell, for example, it is a relentless focus on the customer combined with an almost missionary zeal. For Frederick Smith, True North is a preoccupation with just-in-time delivery to eliminate his customers' inventory buildup. For Jorma Olia, it is a family-oriented culture at Nokia. For William Ford, it's a passion for building a company that is socially conscious. For all those CEOs and others, True North also... also entails careful attention to the needs of their employees. It also encompasses an obsession with exquisite execution of plans, from speed of delivery to cost and quality control. In these and all other cases, CEOs make the point over and over again that the company must stand for something beyond mere profitability, although that is obviously a precondition for success. Their companies must radiate these values over the long period of time through swings in the business cycle and other shifting factors. They must communicate their values in a clear and understandable way to all of their constituents. True North is an intrinsically attractive concept. Who, after all, would not applaud an executive with character and one so firmly grounded? Nevertheless, It's harder than ever for a CEO to exhibit true north today. In the current environment, your strategic directions for any firm need to be reassessed so often that the very idea of strategy often threatens to denote into little more than day-to-day tactics. Organization cultures are also changing as one company merges with another or links up with others through corporate alliances. So many firms seem to be in a constant state of restructuring that the basics that once defined them are in danger of vanishing. Consider the rocky ride at Motorola. Christopher Galvin, grandson of the company's founder and son of the previous chairman and CEO, has worked at Motorola since holding a summer job then in 1967. Like so many of the executives that I met, Galvin is instantly likable for his openness, modesty, and unrestrained optimism. I arrived in his office in Schaumburg, Illinois, the morning that the New York Times ran a long, flattering article about he and his team had engineered Motorola's turnaround. I congratulated him on this achievement. Quote, "We're pleased, but there's a long way to go," he responded. He then went on to describe the past few years at the company and his experience of revamping its fundamental culture. In the late 1990s, Motorola was in deep trouble, in part because it missed important trends in the market for cellular phones. The company had once thrived on a system that fostered the iconoclastic entrepreneur. Quote, "The person was way out on the edge," he said. "The culture encouraged inventions and spin-offs and celebrated the inventor. As a result, there was an almost unending proliferation of products. There were not 10 versions of cellular phones, but 120 versions, Galvin recalled. "Every radio was 90% unique, and therefore there was no commonality. We ended up having to build an enormous number of factory lines, and the cost went higher and higher and higher. It was a successful strategy for many decades, accounting for a number of technological breakthroughs. But Motorola could not survive in an era where customers wanted solutions to complicated problems, not just fancy technology for the sake of the technology. By the late 1990s, this company, which had invented the cellular industry, was losing customers because it was trying to dictate what kinds of mobile phones they should buy. He was being accused of selling shoddy products and was plagued by product delays. It also appeared incapable of producing digital telephones." We're going to continue looking at this in detail in future programs, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.